Today is the 19th of November 2014. I'm interviewing Ian Longley of Hastings and the life and times of himself and his family. Thank you, Ian.
I'm the youngest son of A.W.S. Longley and Amelia Maud Longley. She was the Hales, was born in Wimbledon. She was the eldest daughter of the Hales family down there. They had a farm right opposite where the Wimbledon School is as of now. My father, he came out from England. He was the son of a manager of a coal mine in Yorkshire. He came to New Zealand to Wellington and he started school teaching, and he went up here behind Packy Pack. There was a sawmill up there at that stage, and they had, I think, 8 children there. Mill hands, and he was there as a school teacher and taught them there.
Can you remember approximately what date that was, Ian?
No, I can't remember. So from there he was then transferred to Wimbledon School and was teaching there. My mother was going to school there, and they sort of hit it off pretty quickly, because at that stage it was the only schooling there was, and I think she might have been about 18.
Sure.
When she's still at primary school. So it wasn't long before the relationship was created. Her father, Thomas Hales, he, being a farmer, he thought it'd be a good idea if a father should have a farm. So he set it up for them on the Wimbledon Road, which was about 5 miles from the Wimbledon Hotel north towards Prongy Harbour. They moved in there. It was just a little lean-to shack. But he also, being pretty enterprising, decided that it'd be a good idea if they bought the Wimbledon store. So he bought the Wimbledon store. My mother ran the store. At this stage, there were still coaches coming out from Dunnyburg. My father was always quick to latch on anything new, and he thought it'd be a good idea to start a service car run between Herbertville and Wimbledon. So he bought 2 Cadillac cars, the big open tour ones, where they could put plenty in. And it was only a period of time before he run the coaching company broke. People just wouldn't go in a coach because it was a joke that the wives didn't like their hubbies. They had to stay overnight, and in Dunnyburg and got into all sorts of trouble.
Sure.
So they could see they could get them home again the same day.
Would this be in the 1920s?
Would be, yes, that's right. And then I think he bought also a Minerva, and he had to have the Minerva there as well. That was another big car. And they were quite willing, and he always remarked on that, because he was getting a £100 affair between Herbertville and Dunnyburg.
£100?
In those days, he said, the worst thing about the cars in those eras that everyone else had coaches and on muddy roads and so forth, and the wagons left a narrow track, and if you slipped into that track, you tore the tyre off. So they used to have about 4 spare rims on the back, and they used to ruin tyres every trip. And apart from that, it was cheaper than having to stay overnight. And so he kept that running, so he was successful with that. And of course he had the store, he was still teaching, and had a farm. So I think the education department thought maybe he had too much to do, so they suggested he lead the teaching, which he did.
So how big would the farm have been?
It was about 1,000 acres.
Oh, gosh, oh.
Yeah.
And school teaching, and a store.
Oh, yes. He had a very good man who he employed to drive one of the cars. As he turned out, he was a fix-it man. He could fix anything, no matter what it was.
Mm.
He just fixed it. Dad had the brain, he had the hands, and it was a great combination. In fact, he worked for my father for 40 years. So that was what happened there. The store was leased out when they moved to the farm, when he gave up the teaching. That carried on for many years. I remember one of the ones, at least for a long time, was George Hart. He was there, and in fact, I went to school with his daughter. At that stage, I'm the youngest of 6 children, 4 sisters and 1 brother. They're all deceased, I'm the only one left now. At 84, I'm feeling a bit vulnerable now. Schooling, I used to have to ride from the farm to the Wimbledon School, which was 5 miles, and I used to ride, had a pony, and used to ride it. Those days, there were no such thing as saddles for kids. It was a sack with a surcingle around.
Right.
And I became allergic to the horses, through the horse wet
officer. Oh, gosh.
Yeah. My father bought my second sister, a little singer, used to drive me to school and that in the winter time. But when the roads were bad, sometimes I'd have to stay with my grandmother, Jemima Hales, who lived opposite the school. that was where I was there. Of course, at that stage, I was nearly finished the primary school, and the war came, and there was just an exodus of all young men from the district. It was very noticeable, actually. Very difficult to get people to help if all the young ones had gone. Mm.
So what was it like growing up in that area as a boy? What did you do?
I don't know, because the youngest, I suppose, I got pushed around a bit.
Tagged along.
Yeah, and I tagged along.
Why are you following us?
Yeah. At a very early age, I had a real liking to machinery. In fact, the man who worked for my father, he built a box on the back of the Fordson tractor. My father had one of the first Fordson tractor in the district, one of three in Hawke's Bay altogether. The local farmers used to laugh and used to reckon he was going to fill all the gullies up the kerosene tins. There was a bit of a joke about it. Anyway, I was sat in the box maybe, I don't know, three or four, and I went out riding on the tractors.
Yes.
And I became that way inclined.
So were they rubber-tired tractors or steel?
Oh, no, they were steel right back then. They were just a diagonal bars.
Yes.
Across.
So it wouldn't have been very comfortable riding
on
it.
Oh, terrible. So when the war came, where was I going to go to school? That was the next thing. So because I just had pneumonia the second time, my father thought we'd better get away to school, and it was during a midterm, and the only place they could get me in was at Whanganui at St George's College, and that was a preparatory to collegiate. That was an experience for me. I'd never been on a train before. I'd never been away from home, and it was all pretty scary stuff as a young lad. But it was very interesting life in those few years I had at St George's. Because the war was on, we had Chinese, American, English, Dutch children. People were sending the children to the safe place in New Zealand. They were going up to St George's. There was a real mixed thing, and I never forget the American boy. We called him Yank, and he went to him because he always had money, so he was our banker, and he always, of course, had interest on us. And then from St George's, I was, of course, meant to go on to a collegiate, and I said to my father, no, I don't want to go to collegiate. He said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I want to go to Whanganui Technical College. So that's where I went. Loved it because it had the workshops and everything.
Sure,
I was happy making things, doing things.
And did you play any sports while you were in Whanganui?
No, not a good sportsman at all. It was never part of my scene. Never was, never has been, actually.
Yes.
I've just kept my hands busy, and I like making things or doing things.
Sure.
So when I'd finished there, I went back to the farm. At that stage, my brother was an agriculture contractor, and my father had set him up, and at that stage had an early Caterpillar crawler tractor, which was pretty new then, and the thing to have. And he went on, and Dad bought him the second tractor, and he was contracting. My brother got sick of that and decided that wasn't him, so he shut it down, and I ended up with the tractors. One was in a bit of a worn-out state, so my job was to try and get it together. I worked there mainly on the farm, doing nearly all the tractor work. Anything with wheels, I was doing it, and I was the fix-it man, from fixing the roof to whatever. So I became pretty handy. The second Caterpillar tractor started using oil, so I decided to pull it down and took Dad into letting me pull it down and just find out what's wrong, and it needed a set of rings and it needed new cylinders on it. I'm in the proceeds of doing this when, unknown to me of course, that the Caterpillar representatives and one of the head men from America were visiting around different clients who had their product in New Zealand. They must have heard about me, I presume, because I was ordering parts. So they came out, and they were amazed as I was there just timing up the fuel pump and what I'd done. And two guys were there, and they turned to my dad, and they said, well, it's like this, Mr. Longley, we want your son in America. Dad said, oh, well, you better talk to my son about this. So they talked to me, and I said, yeah, sounds a pretty good idea. They're going to put me through the training, you know. So we hadn't signed anything, but it was all agreed to go, and the mum wasn't very happy about me going to America at all, but she agreed it would probably be the best thing. So everything was set, and then, blow me down, Dad had a heart attack. Mum looked at me and she says, you still going to go to America? She said, I really need you here. And I said, yeah, I understand. So I stayed. So I didn't do the opportunity. I then became fully involved in the farm. I carried on. I got married when I was 22, I think it was, to a Whanganui girl I'd went to school with. We raised six children out there. We've since parted our ways, as sometimes happens. My children's still all alive. My youngest boy was right into mechanical things, of course. And I set him up here in Havelock North, servicing Mercedes-Benz for a number of years up on an orchard on Napier Road. He started collecting all the old Benzes around the bay and selling them off for spare parts. He was pretty happy there, actually, and then one of the agents who used to be my neighbour out at Prongau, Tony Bailey, came to see me. He said, "Hey," he said, "you interested in selling that orchard you bought off the Davis family?" And I said, "Why?" He said, "I think I'll get you good money." I said to my son Michael, I said, "Well, it looks like we're going to shut down. Might have to move from here." So he did. He moved to Napier. And I actually sold that property to an Australian couple who are now call it the Yamada Figure. That was that there.
Well, going back to the farm, obviously, did you still do any contracting or did you just run the
farm? Oh, yes, I was contracting big boy. Yeah.
They would have been the Cat 22s that you had originally, were they? Or T20s?
The Caterpillars went very quickly and I started experimenting with other tractors. My dad was, of course, being Englishman, he liked to have everything English, Jaguars and Rovers and all that in his lifetime. He was convinced he should buy a Fowler Marshall a crawler tractor because he was the CEO of the power board in Waipakarau, and Tom Lowry had one. They got their heads together and the father thought he should buy one for me, so we went with those for a number of years. I had two of them. But most of my contracting was done with hay contracting. Found that was something I could fit in with the 1,000-acre farm I'm running. That was very successful. I had a woman that worked with me for 19 years on the farm, and she became very good. Everyone in the district used to talk about her. I reckon she was worth two men. And she did the farm work while I did the contracting.
And so what sort of equipment did you use for the farm contracting? New Holland or John Deere?
No, well, that is interesting because we had Ferguson to start with. My dad had the second Ferguson that came into the bay. He was innovative, you know,
yes,
and he liked the idea of the three-point linkage. We started off with Ferguson's and I kept up the Ferguson's, of course, got bigger and bigger, as you seem to do. One year we were predicted we were going to have a drought. The drought was due. And it was going to be a good one. We could see that happening. And I thought about that. And previously I was selling hay off the farm and the demand was too great. And I knew some local Maoris of Prongau just on the Wimbledon Road before you go over the hill into Prongau. All those flats in there that owned them. I went and had a talk and I said, "What are you doing with those paddocks?" I said, "Why?" I said, "I'd like to lease them off it for 2 months, a whole lot." We agreed to a price and I'd offered a better price than what they were getting from the grazing. So I went in and put down the tine harrows and pulled them right through all the paddocks to pick up all the wire and bits and pieces laying around. So I didn't want any of that in the mowers. It so happened I made a real killing in that first year of doing that with money. On the farm we always had a Land Rover, one of the first that came out. My dad was into Romany studs and we had to go up to Maxwell to get a stud ram, a replacement stud ram. So we went to the Land Rover. I had a little crate on the back and away we go. And coming back by Martin, blast of steam out the front of us and it blew the core out of the radiator. Big chunk went flying. Yeah. I walked for a while and found a house and went and phoned up Palmerston North and eventually found Manawatu Motors were the agents for Land Rover. I rang them up and they said, "Yes, we'll send a truck for you right away and pick you up." Now, this was about 7:30 at night. They eventually picked up and went to Manawatu Motors. And while we're there waiting, the mechanic came and he says, "You wouldn't believe this. We've got a brand new radiator sitting upstairs with this model." They set about putting the new radiator in. So while Father and I were just watching, you know, the main door goes up and in comes the Mercedes and the salesman drives it round, puts it in the showroom and he starts polishing this. This is quite late by this stage. So Dad being curious about liking nice cars and that, he wandered over to have a look at it, you see. Well, he's looking at it I wandered over, and the mechanic spotted Dad and started doing the hard sell on him. Now, it was interesting because that Mercedes had come from Waipawa. It was a state car. It had only done just a few miles. That's all right. The radio is in the Land Rover, so we go home. That was on a Friday night. I rang Dad on a Sunday, I think it was, my father, and I said to him, "What are you doing on Monday?" And he said, "Oh, I suppose we're going back to Palmerston North." Because he'd asked me previously, he said to me one day we'd been into the stock sale in Waipak, and he said, "Tell me, son," he said, "what sort of a car would you like to own?" I said, "I want a Rolls Royce, Dad." And he looked at me and he says, "And with that attitude, you'll own one." I was serious, because I just liked the best of the lot. So anyway, that was a pipe dream, but I said it. On the Monday morning, we went back to Manawatu. So the salesman says, "Arrive," you see, and takes my father into the office and starts doing a hard sell on him again. And I'm sitting in behind the wheel of the Mercedes, the 220, just looking at all the dials and everything on it, and I liked all the chrome in it. The salesman said to my father, he said, "Well, what do you think about this?" He said, "Who's talked to me?" He says, "The buyer's sitting behind the wheel there." And the guy, he couldn't believe it because I was so young, you know. He came and got me in the office to see, and Dad was watching, so just sat back in the chair and was watching, see how I was going to manage the deal. He said, "Well, you know, what you put it and terms can be this," and he went like that. I said, "No, I'll pay for it by check." I pulled out the pink checkbook and he nearly fell over. You know what that represents, don't you? Murray Roberts checkbook.
Course.
I experienced that in Wellington. It's like opening the vault door.
Well, I used to be a contractor too, and most of my clients all paid Dalgetty's checks, Murray Roberts, De Pellichet, they all had their...
But the Murray Roberts one, you never question it. I actually met Murray Roberts himself. So he said, "Okay," so he accepted the check. And he looked at it and Dad said, "Yeah, that's fine, that's all set." He said, "Well, I'll take you for the drive in the car. You have to have a drive." I said, "No, I don't want to drive." He said, "But you have to drive it before I let you take it." I said, "No, I want it on the horse." And he was a bit flabbergasted. And my Dad said to him, he said, "I think you should just listen to what he said, want it on the horse." Went on the horse, and when I had a look at it, I could see that the shock absorbers in the Mercedes were inside the spring. And on the metal roads of Prong Howe up there, because it was metal roads all the way from Wanstead, as you know. And the shock absorbers in the whole station where you had them got flattened. Twice a year they put new shocks on it. When I saw that, I knew it and had a good look, and it was stone-proof underneath. That's what I was thinking of. And that was a very successful car that I drove that to about 146,000 miles, I think it was. A lovely car.
Coming back to your Fowler Marshall, we tried it out in the paddock, tried it out with roller discs and harrows, and this thing would just keep pulling, but it wasn't very quick. It was quite slow, but it would pull it. It didn't matter what we put on the back of it, but this tractor was immaculate.
Well, actually, talking about the Fowler tractors, because as I mentioned before, I've forgotten his name, and just talked about the Fowler and the farmer, can't think of his name now. He got the World Tractor anyway. It was with Dad on the power board. And he had a plough specially made for that Fowler tractor, and he had five furrows on the back of it. And he said he could still pull it with ease.
I know. There was no wheel slip because the big motor probably only fired five times to the revolution.
Yeah, well, they originated because the Fowler were a traction engine.
That's
people.
Right.
It started with a cartridge start. I still have a packet of cartridges in the shed.
So what size Massey Ferguson did you get up to?
I went to the 185, I think it was. Now, from then, bearing in mind, I had my first Mercedes, and I bought the next one. The first one, when I bought it, I realised it was still six children taken to school, and I thought, I can't take children to school in a Mercedes. Mm. People noses out of joint. It wasn't.
That's right.
So what I did, and I went back to a service over at Manawatu Motor. I said, "I'm in a quandary. I don't know what to buy, because everything I look at now and bought this is rubbish." And he said, "Buy another one, the second hand." And I hadn't thought of it. So I did, and I bought a diesel, an early one. And it had a straight seat in the front, so, you know, you could squeeze everybody in it. Now, that, I sold that with 480,000 miles on it. Bill Stevenson done the engine up once, and I'd cracked the head on it, because they had cast heads in those days, and I didn't survive too well. If you can understand by then, I've got Mercedes on the brain. So I was a great customer of Cable Price, because I made friends with... He was a parts guy in Seaview at Campbell Price where they originally were, and I'd take the Mercedes down there servicing, and I'd also had, I went from Caterpillar to Alice Chalmers. I had an HD5 and then I had the HD6 EO model. So Campbell Price knew me well, I spent a lot of money with him.
Sure.
So I made friends with the parts guy. He said to me one day, he says, "Hey, we've got Rover clubs and we've got Rolls Royce clubs and we haven't got a Mercedes club. Why don't you start a Mercedes-Benz club?" And he kept prompting me for years. About 10 years he kept prompting me.
Yes.
I never did anything until I decided to do it. With Mercedes in my mind, I was, Campbell Price were supplying me with Mercedes books, of course, and I was real friendly with the general manager, and he rang me up and he says, "Hey, I want to ask you something." He says, "We brought in 6 Mercedes tractors. They're down in Christchurch. We thought they'd be good sellers down there, and we can't sell one of them." And I said, "Is that right?" He said, "Yes." I said, "I've read about those." He said, "What do you think?" "Well," I said, "you reckon you can get one to me?" Just like that. And I said, "Well, what sort of commission will you give me?" He says, "Why? I think I can probably sell a few more," which I did. I sold 4 on the bay. And my carrier bought one. It was Mackie's Transport. Another one was a hedge cutter. I can't think of his name. Lilburn Estate bought one. They also bought mine when I sold a farm. And those Mercedes tractors are still going with a contractor down in Levin.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I have seen the one that's got the hedge cutter on it. Frank Hooper and Havelock built it up originally.
Yeah,
and
that's
his
right.
son-in-law
that's
took
right.
it to Central.
Yeah, it was sort of based down in
Takedown. That's right. That's the only Mercedes I've ever seen.
You never ever come across mine?
No.
Yeah, I set mine up with jewels front and rear on it. We had to get a German rotary hoe for it, a big one, and it was big gear went behind it. Then I get a ring from Campbell Price and Christchurch. "Mr. Longley, we have down here, we've repossessed a Mercedes-Benz tractor." I said, "Oh yeah, what is it?" "Oh, it's a 700. And I said, "Oh yeah, I've read about those. Wouldn't mind one of those." He said, "We could do a very good deal with you." I said, "Oh, I don't know, it's too far down there." He said, "We'll fly you down. Don't worry, we'll fly you down." So flew me down there, took one look, and I'd already bought it anyway. You know? So those two worked in conjunction, haymaking.
So how many horsepower was the 700?
The 70, and a 4-cylinder, and it used the same pistons and all valve gear and everything as the 1418, the truck. They chopped 2 off. That same engine went into the Unimog, and the tractor was built, and this is the interesting about, a lot of people didn't realise Mercedes built tractors. What they did, some enterprising guy over there thought about it and thought, "Why don't we make a tractor? We've got engines, we've got gearboxes from the trucks, we've got diffs and transfer hubs and everything from the trucks." They put it together. So it was the only tractor that had a synchronous gearbox. Mine was the first out on the farm, and we had trouble changing gear. And they had a very, very clever guy that worked for Campbell Price, and he was a Falchman for New Zealand. Mm. They sent him up to me, and he came up with the truck with all the tools and jacks and everything he might want. He was going to fix it, you know. So we pulled the gearbox out of it, and we pulled it to pieces, because I had a pretty good workshop out, a good place to work. He scratched his head and thought about it, had a few smokes, and we talked about it. He said, "I think I know what's wrong with this." I says, "What?" "See these synchro rings?" I says, "Yeah." He says, "This gearbox is made for a truck which travels at from 20 to 80 miles an hour.
Sure.
And here it is in a tractor, all the gears are going too slow." He said, "You got a rat tail file?" And I said, "Yes." So we got out and the rat tail filed inside of the slip and fixed it. That's all it was. Fixed it just like that. So, you know, we talk about Cocky's been, you know, number 8 wire thinking, and that's where he was, you know. Yeah. I was quite impressed with how he...
Yeah, some people have that ability to fix the problem.
Exactly. And the small tractor, when I sold the farm, my neighbour said, "I want that small tractor. Got to have that Mercedes," because he saw how it worked and where it went. I got a ring from him one day and he says, "I think I need your help. I think I need your HD6. He said, "I've done a silly thing and I've driven into a spring with my D4. And it was sunk. So I said, "Okay." And I said, "Give us an hour and I'll be over." I said, "You better cut the fences and let us through the boundary." And of course, I whistled over in the MB track, didn't I? He said, "What are you going to do with that?" I said, "Well, this will pull more than the HD6 will." He didn't believe me, of course. Mm. So he hopped up on the dicky seat and his tractor's down there, you know. Mm. And he said, "You might have to go around and up and down and around to get to it." I said, "What's wrong with going down here?" And he just looked, and I just locked up the diff locks and went straight down. He couldn't believe it. Then we drove over the spring, It didn't even skid the wheel, it popped him straight out.
Well, I suppose you've got 8 tyres on the ground.
And then I turned around and climbed back out where I went. And he says, "I won't take my D4 up there." Yeah. That was his lesson about the actual tractor.
Yes.
And I've had, I don't know how many people came from South Island to see me working with the MB track because it was so stable on the sidelings. Mm. I remember I was the rotary hoeing. We'd scrub rate, I bought a block off the Maoris, which was an interesting thing in itself because you can't buy land off Maoris. This lady was a ropier from Prongahau and she'd seen me working and what I was doing and she wanted, the neighbours want to buy it and no, she wouldn't sell it. She wanted me to have it. Said to her husband, Ian's got to have that. How are we going to do it? And she worked for a lawyer in Dannyburg, guy with the glass eye.
Yes, I know the chap you mean.
He says, oh, that's easy. Europeanise yourself. She did. Yeah. She could legally sell it to me.
Now, what was his name now?
Yeah, it's on the tip of my tongue.
Frank Gordon, had he moved out into your area when you were still there?
No, I don't think. The name rings a bell.
Yeah, it would have been later, probably. Mm. So the farm itself, you ran mainly cattle, sheep?
Yeah, Angus and Romany. Dad used to breed at his own Tarwin Old Stud. When I took over, a friend of mine who was a stock agent for WMK, actually, he suggested I put the Hereford Cross through them, which I did, and then they roared away. I also had a block of land at Prongahau, on the Prongahau Strait going down to the beach, and that was family lands left to my mother from the Lambert Estate.
That was all flat land?
All flat.
That's
was,
right. Yes,
on,
I know the
on the left-hand side going to the river. And when my mum and dad retired, they retired to the old vicarage and leased the church land. They had some of the acres there and he used to run his stud there. And they did that right up until they passed on.
You would know the old Prongahau Hotel probably well too.
There was a joke about me one day. I tell you, it's interesting because we'd been down haymaking. I think a beer's in order. So hopped in there on the way home and thought I'd have a beer and there's a few guys and their locals there, and they're talking about which was the best car, whether it was a Holden or a Ford, and there was quite a discussion going on. And I walked in, and I said, oh, I'm nice talking to you, Longley. You've got stars in your eyes. I said, oh, you probably have. And the croppy says, why don't you buy a Mercedes motorbike? I said, we don't make one, just in the silence, it's gospel. In other words, if they hadn't been, they would have had one. Because I had G-Wagons as a replacement to the Land Rover. And I've had them right up until just a few years ago when I sold the last one. It was all Mercedes on the farm.
Yes. And the old Prongahau pub, were you there when the American lady managed it?
Oh, yes.
We used to go down there now and again for Christmas lunch once. Very hospitable place.
Yeah, it always has been too.
Well, I guess it was an area that people had to make their own fun because you all had to live with one another. And so you... I was still doing harvesting as well as the agricultural work.
Yeah, right up until I sold up. It was interesting, I had four sons and I remember Dad saying to me, who are you going to leave the farm to? And I thought, oh, it's a bit hard to work this out. So I said to him, I said, okay, what you've got to do when you finish school, you go and get a trade, each one of you, and we'll see who comes back to the farm. None of them did.
Now, I think there were some opportunities, and I came through the same era as you did. It was a wonderful life. I think that some of those opportunities are there now, but it's so costly for some of these young men to get into it.
We're in a different... Everything's different. The tractors are 10 times different than what they used to be, and the machinery is absolutely ridiculously priced.
And so you carried on with that sort of lifestyle until you retired, and you retired... To here?
No, I retired to Lane Road in Havelock. Had a nice property up there. Unfortunately, I bought a split-level house with stairs in it, and then my knees packed up on me. So I thought, well, that's not the place to be with crook knees. I'd have heart problems too.
So what are the highlights? You've obviously travelled.
Obviously, yeah. I went to Mercedes-Benz factory.
Chose that you care?
We had a meeting up in Taupo, and yes. I suggested... For the 100-year celebration, Mercedes-Benz was coming up. Who'd like to go with me over to the anniversary? And I was surprised. There was 20 hands shot up just like that. And we contacted the Australian club, and we had about 12 come from there as well. We got a professional to organise a tour. We went to the States first, to LA, and went to the main distributing place for Mercedes. So that was really interesting, that. It was very interesting when they showed me a crate opened up and one of the Mercedes had broken free of its anchorage and it was just crumpled piece of metal that destroyed itself.
Just, yeah, it doesn't take much. The weight of it thumping around.
The rusties or whatever it was. It might have been dropped a couple of times, I don't know. But
so that was a very successful trip, obviously.
Yeah, so we went to Berlin and had a look through there. And, of course, the Berlin Wall was still up then. And that was interesting going through into the east because I couldn't believe it. I just walked in and stood there and looked. The whole place was grey. The people looked grey. Mm-hmm. The clothes were grey. Yes, it was terrible. I felt real uncomfortable. So I wasn't impressed with that at all. And then, of course, we went to Stuttgart to the factory. Now, they knew that there was a Mercedes-Benz Club coming from New Zealand. And they're there to greet us when we arrived in the bus. And boy, did they lay it on for us. They laid on a dinner with the hierarchy. And when they realised that I was a New Zealand patron, God, I had to go and sit up with the CEO, didn't I? That was quite a nerve-wracking experience for an old cocky.
But I mean, you'd bought your way into Mercedes-Benz, yeah, hadn't you? With all your tractors and cars. You were just getting your right dues.
It was very interesting. I was amazed that everything, the crockery, everything had the star on it, of course, you know. Even the sugar was wrapped up in a little square with a photo of a car on it or the star.
Good
Lord. I've got some sitting in the sideboard there, can you brought back? Because I was intrigued with them. I was looking at them, and one of the other Mercedes hierarchy there saw me, and he grabbed a handful and put them in my pocket, so I still got them.
And so you've been, obviously, you worked your way up as the president and the patron of the Mercedes Club, or did you become the patron?
I became patron very early on because I was the founder. And you know, would you believe it, you know, way out of Prongout, I became the founder of the club. It was interesting.
And so are you still involved as the patron?
Oh, yes. I've just come back. We've been up to Tirau to their Christmas party up there, Midlands Club, and I presented High Mileage Awards to some of the members there. One had done a million Ks. He drove courier vans, so he got his million K pin. I'm an owner of a 2 million K pin. There's the award up just there alongside you there. And that was presented to me by a special function in Hamilton by Mercedes-Benz.
And how strong is the club locally?
I don't know much about it locally. I'm not involved locally. I range between all the clubs because they're all invited everywhere. And we had bit of a difference of opinion, so I thought it'd be better to move on. That happens sometimes. I'm a life member also, so if you could say all my time has really been involved in the 40 years with Mercedes-Benz and the club.
Certainly a very loyal client, and they had a quality that a lot of others, and yet when you looked at them, they were very simple. I mean, the motors were not complicated. Of course, at that time, we didn't have an active Mercedes garage in Hastings. Bill Crosby was, Bill, he was a very good diagnostic mechanic.
He was a Mercedes trader. He was a better seller than
that. Absolutely. So really, that pretty well sums up. You've retired here in what I would call a park-like section. Mm. It's absolutely lovely. I guess, Les, have you got anything else that...
Not really. No, I think that covers it pretty well. My partner and I have been together for 20 years, and we seem to be getting on pretty good.
How many vehicles did you say you'd had?
55.
That's including your tractors
and
trucks?
That's including the trucks. I had a Unimog, I bought a new Unimog. Oh. You know, the same as the Army?
Yes. Did Mangarapa have...
They had trucks.
They had Mercedes, didn't they?
Yes.
Max Mark.
Max, he loved Mercedes. He lived up the road here.
That's right, I know.
This recording was done for the sake of the family. I realised myself that I know very little about the family because when I left home in 1906, I was 18 at that time. One of the 18 years old, I concerned more about the living than the dead. Result is that anything that I know is purely hearsay, as I remember it from my own parents. My father always told me that so far as he could go back the family history, that the first ancestor that we knew anything about came from France. He was a Frenchman with Henry V. That would be after the Battle of Agincourt, 1415, I think. So far as I can understand, he was a valet at one of the king's men there. That's all I knew about it, and it's pure hearsay, of course. He also talked a bit about an Archbishop of Canterbury, who apparently was a member of their family, but I was never been able to prove that was correct. But recently I've looked up the encyclopedias and found quite a bit on him. Whether to put it here or not, I'm not at all sure. His name was Charles Thomas Longley, born in 1794 and died in 1868. He was born at Rochester, educated at Winchester and Christ College, and then Oxford. He was ordained in 1823, headmaster of Harrow in 1829, first bishop of Ripon in 1836, bishop of Durham in 1856, archbishop of York in 1860, archbishop of Canterbury in 1862. He was a great uncle, as far as I know, of myself, and also was my godfather. He was present at the wedding of Queen Victoria, and that is as far as anything I know about him. I also understand, Dad said at different times, that my grandfather was a coachman in Queen Victoria for some considerable time. But whether there's any truth in that, I don't know, and I'm certainly not going to find out. A portrait of him is in my possession, and also a snuff box which he gave me for a Christmas present. I have a booklet about the history of the Ripon Cathedral, and as a boy, I once sang at Ripon Cathedral. I was born in Dartfield, Yorkshire, on the 22nd of April, 1887. My parents were Arthur Longley and Louise Mason. They originally came from the south of England just after they were married. Strange to say, both of them were interested and worked for the railways at that period. As a matter of fact, Mother always told us she was one of the first woman operators in the Morse code. Dad eventually became a station master on the London-Brighton South Coast Railway line. After having stayed at various country stations, my father eventually left the railway to join with a big colliery business in Yorkshire and became a business manager, the one belonging to a local millionaire. He was on the clerking side of the business and had nothing to do with the digging and the coal itself. He did this for a good few years, of course. The whole of our family was steeped in the thing because we were born and bred in a coal mining community. In fact, as a young boy, while still going to school, I very often had to help down the mine with the engineer because the engineer's son was a school friend of mine. He had the opportunity on occasion to go down and took me with him. It was quite an experience. I was always more or less scared, as all young boys would be, going down these mines, till I got used to it. The mines were 600 yards deep, so it was quite a distance. On the way there is a little story I could attach to this. On Saturday afternoons, this boy and myself used to go down to the colliery, into the engineering part where all the machinery was, and there was always plenty of steam up, so we'd use the lathe. He was very clever. As a matter of fact, when we were almost about 15 or 16, between the two of us, we built a motorbike, built on an ordinary pushbike frame. We bought parts of the engine and turned others up at the colliery. Anyway, I was about to tell you of a fright I got on one particular Saturday. We were falling about over the top of the mine shaft, as it had its mouth a big flat surface of steel, because as the tubs, as they used to call them, the little wagons full of coal used to come up in the cages from the pit below and were pushed onto the steel platform, where they could be pushed anywhere across the steel platform. Anyway, we were falling about, skidding on this beautiful slippery surface. I was doing a particularly long slide. My friend pushed me, and he pushed me right into the gates that stopped one from falling into the mine. The gate swung over the top of the mine mouth while I clung on like grim death. There were 600 yards underneath me, and I was helpless there until he had the brains enough to come and pull the gate back. I never forgot that part. Even in those days, the pit and the ponies were working, for if a mine had been worked for many years, it was an extensive walk to the coalface. The ponies were periodically brought up every 3 months for a change, but they still went blind after many years in the dark. In my father's day, boys of 6 and 7 years of age used to work pushing the wagons through the narrow tunnels, often unable to stand upright. The wagons contained up to half a ton of coal at a time. In the mine shaft mentioned above, the cages went up and down alternately, passing each other. Each cage took up to 3 layers of the little trucks on 3 floors. The men used the same cages, 8 to 20 men to a cage. A good seam would be 6 to 7 feet thick of coal. A ductella was an overseer over a gang of coal workers working at the face. He worked almost as a contractor would. One of his jobs was to see that the coal was organised into the wagons drawn by the ponies. Off the course, my younger sister Elsie's husband was killed down a mine. Harold Carter was a date teller, and he was killed by a fall of the roof of the tunnel. He was living and went to England in 1948. I can't remember a great deal about my early youth. I don't know why. I had 3 sisters, all older than myself, up to 20 years older. They had a governess while they were young, but I was educated until I was about 8 years old by my sisters. School was 2.5 miles from our house, and there was no other way to go except to walk. And that's the only education I got until I went to school. I also had a brother older than myself and a sister younger than myself. That was 6 of us. My brother was 10 years older than I, and is, of course, dead now. I think my father's one of the most versatile men I ever knew. He could almost do anything. He was a wonderful singer and had a beautiful baritone voice. He sang in quite a few of the cathedrals and big churches around Yorkshire. His son Dick, my brother, followed him, as I followed Dick into the local church. I did quite a bit of singing too. In fact, father was a baritone singer. We used to go to the annual festivals at various cathedrals, for instance, Sheffield, Winchester, York's Minster and Durham. I sang in all these cathedrals as a choir boy. Not a particularly good one, though I must have some sort of voice, otherwise I would not have been able to get there. Then, this time, when I first started school, Dad left the coal mine job managing and joined what was then the equivalent of a Social Security department. He was an officer of the poor law, as it was called, acting similarly as a social welfare officer. He also had a commission that allowed him to, with assistance of doctors, to admit people to the various institutions, chiefly called the workhouses. In other words, he was just a public servant, although until his death, at any rate until his retirement. At this time, one of Father's jobs used to be was to provide transport to take these people to the workhouse, or for certified patients to the lunatic asylum, which were not in our village but at Wakefield, a country town in the west riding of Yorkshire. Naturally, as a boy, I wanted to go too. Father took me with him when I was about 10. He sat with the patient and the policeman in the closed part of the cab while I sat with the cabbie. I saw some extraordinary sights. I saw the way in which the lunatic was first strapped up to prevent him becoming violent. The straitjacket was a strong sheet with long tapes attached. 2 policemen would hold either end of the sheet and stand either side of the patient. Suddenly they would turn him in opposite directions and wrap him up. When we arrived at the asylum and went inside, we walked through a big hall full of all sorts of people. There were Queen Victorians, Napoleons, etc. I wanted to see a padded cell, so they showed me one and let me go inside. It was small, about 6 foot by 6 foot, all lined with padded leather with no windows in the walls. There was a small window in the ceiling, out of reach, which admitted the only light the room had. There was, of course, no electricity in those days. I walked inside. Even the floor was padded, which was most disconcerting. It was spongy and gave nothing solid to step on. Then they shut me in. My curiosity soon gave way to fright in those eerie surroundings. I wasn't left there more than a few minutes, but it was long enough to convince me the cell was a good place to lose one's sanity, not regain it. This one has headed a young runaway's trip to London. It must have been about this time that I decided to visit London. England was covered in railway lines in those days. To take a day's excursion train from my home in Yorkshire to London cost about 10 shillings. I emptied my piggy bank and found I had sufficient for the trip and little left over to spend. I was confident that I would be all right, for my uncle was a station master at Victoria Station, the terminal for the South Brighton Line, and I intended to visit him. So I went without my parents' knowledge. He had to get up very early in order to catch the Clewston train. It took about 3 hours travelling time. When I arrived, I found my terminal was on the north side of London, and I had to get across London to reach Victoria Station. I found the underground and spent a further 2 hours going round and round, trying to find the right station on which to alight and missing it. I eventually came to recognise the station before the one I wanted and finally got off at the right place and found my uncle. He was dressed in the manner of a station master of those days, in a frock coat and a top hat. By this time the police were already looking for me, having been alerted to my disappearance and probably destination. I enjoyed my holiday. Once there, I was allowed to stay a week. I remember seeing horse-drawn trams over the embankment. But when I went back home, I had no pocket money for several weeks at least. I went to school, of course, when I was little more than an infant, and they put me into Standard 3. It was a local school that were in those days called a ward, similar to primary school. I put in the usual years until I was in Standard 7. And passed a school leaving certificate. Then, as a matter of fact, I wanted to work in the colliery because I had made up my mind that I was going to be an engineer. But Father had a different idea. He found out that I was messing about in his colliery at that time. He hadn't known I was working on Saturdays doing a little bit in the way of odd jobs here and there. But he eventually found out. And one Saturday at length, he said to me, "Bill," he says, "you're starting school teaching on Monday." I said, "Oh, was that the idea?" And he said, "Yes." I said, "Where am I going to start?" "Oh," he says, "down at Perk School down there. I've appreciated for 4 years for teaching profession." And I said, "That's very nice indeed. Of course, in those days, you didn't check your father too much, but I had to grin and bear it." So I went through with it, and for the next 4 years until I was 18, that was 4 years, I suppose. I went to Barnsley Pupils Teacher Centre, which is much the same as a teacher's college here. I didn't take my matriculation. I took the King's Scholarship, which is equivalent, but with a teacher's certificate, you see. But I never attended a university regularly. I did put in quite a few extramural lectures and that sort of thing. By the way, the conditions are a bit different then to now. I did 3 days of work a week at the Pupil Teacher Centre and 3 days of practical at the school. And that's how we filled in the 4 years of apprenticeship. Wages were quite good in those days. I got £5 for the first year, £7.10 for the second, £10 for the next, and £12.10 for the last year. Now you can realise why I was dependent on my parents. Of course, when I got my teacher's certificate, I took a job at the local school. I stayed there 6 months because I wanted to save enough money to come out to New Zealand or some other such place. I had already made a mind to do this, and after 6 months I got in touch with New Zealand Commissioner in London, got an assisted passage. The cost of the passage was £10. I had to sign up to work on the main trunk railway that was going through at the time. This was in 1906. I turned 19-year-old when we were in the Bay of Biscay, and I arrived in this country on the 2nd of June 1906. The trip to New Zealand. The voyage was very typical for those days. It took 7 weeks to come out to New Zealand. There was nothing really of consequence to happen during the voyage. It was a steamship, the SS Turakina, which was eventually sunk by the Germans in the First World War in the Atlantic. She was a very stable ship. I never got seasick or anything like that. We enjoyed every minute of the voyage, although we were cooped up pretty well. There were about 500 of us. It was a meat boat which came back as a passenger boat by filling up all the freezing chambers with divisions and the extras to provide that was supposed to be the cabins. There were lots of complaints about the food, although I could never understand it. I put on about a stone and a half coming to New Zealand. I thoroughly enjoyed every bit of it. Anyway, we stopped at Tenerife and had a day out there. There was one incident there that I mustn't forget, this one. A friend and I had in the cabin with me, I had two berth cabin, came from the same place as I did. He got off and he was going to have a good time. All I had was a couple of pounds my father had given me when I had left. I wasn't going to squander it. Well, my cabin mate left me, and the next morning we picked him up just before the boat was due to sail in the gutter. He had been thoroughly stunned and he didn't know where he was. He'd lost every penny he'd got. Everything had been carried away. They'd even taken his trousers off and put on an old pair. He hadn't had a good time at all, and he didn't like to talk too much about it. Next port of call was at Cape Town. We went ashore for a day and had a look around Table Mountain. I can remember going up. In those days, there was no aerial railway there as it is now. We walked up some distance, but we did not have a great deal of time. I remember picking up some silver leaves of some plant I've never seen before, but that is the only thing I really remember about Cape Town. We carried on, and what surprised me, the ship went a long way around the south of Cape Town, or is down to Caroline Islands, which, as a matter of fact, we could see in the distance. And then it took an easterly shot straight across to West Australia. In that distance, we never passed a ship of any description. It took 2 to 3 weeks to cross. I can't remember exactly. On the voyage, we actually saw whales. Also, on suitable days, we put sails up. That was the only time I was on a sailing boat. The engine was stopped and the sails put up to save fuel. We stopped again at Perth and then on across the Australian Blight. We saw whales again and called in Adelaide, and another day again in Melbourne. I remember little bits about those days, but nothing particularly special. An unusual call we did was to Hobart. If I remember, we had a day or 2 days there before we came over to New Zealand. During a voyage over, the great earthquake at San Francisco occurred. Of course, there was no radio in those days, and we didn't know anything about it until we got right to New Zealand and read it in the papers that it had gone past. Prime Minister, the late Dick Seddon, was on board. He came over from Australia and died on the voyage. I never actually met him. I arrived on the 2nd of June 1906, and we stayed in Wellington overnight. And the next morning, an immigration officer came aboard to pick up the immigrants and agreed to go and work on the main trunk line. Well, my cabin mate and myself kept ourselves out of the way. The officer eventually went ashore without finding us, so thinking we might get into trouble, decided to clear out where a boat going up the coast. The boat was known for many years as the old Taloon, although she was practically new when this happened. There were lots of boats up and down the coastal routes then, and she was operating between Wellington, Napier, Gisborne and Auckland. We came up as far as Napier, for I was arranged to meet a so-called uncle of mine who had married a very early settler related to me and my marriage. He was her second husband. She had come in very early indeed, around about 1840, to Auckland. Got as far as Napier and stayed in a hotel there, my first night of sleeping on New Zealand soil. Next morning I took a train and came to Waipawa, where this relative lived. We stayed a couple of days until I contacted a local farmer up in the Wakawara at a place called Blackburn, which is still on the map, and I got a job working for him. Unfortunately, being a new chum, I didn't ask about the wages before I started. I stayed a month and rather enjoyed it. The weather impressed me. I had left England in spring and it was now midsummer here in New Zealand. I expected mild winters, though it's never happened since. During that first month, it never even rained, although there was snow on the tops of the mountain range. Most of the work itself was rather unpleasant. I was skinning dead hoggets all the time. I was unused to it and wasn't over keen on it for a job. I didn't even have the proper clothes to wear. Coming straight from home, I hadn't known what to expect, and I'd already lost a pair of shoes, my Sunday boots, almost opposite Cape Town again. My cabin mate was in the top bunk, and the only place to put one's boots was under the bottom bunk with the top sticking out. He used them overnight, suffering from the seasickness. Made a real mess of them. We sent him overboard. After a month at this farm, I asked for my wages, and he gave me £1. And I said, "Look, Mr. So-and-so," I said, "I won't tell you his name because his family is still about." He is Scandinavian, by the way. "I would really like to have had all my wages now," I told him. "That's all of them," he said. I said, "What, for a month's work?" He said, "Yes, you're a new chum. You know, you're only worth $5 a week." "Oh," I said, "am I? Bless my soul, I've been doing the same work as the other bloke on the place. As a matter of fact, he's been making me do most of it. He put me onto all the unpleasant jobs. Five bob isn't so good, is it? Oh, well, he said, that's all we give a new chum. We only give 5 shillings. Well, if that's all you can afford, I said, you'd better keep it and buy yourself some tobacco. The reason for my comment was that every time he had seen me on the place, he would stop and light up a cigarette. If he had papers, he had no matches, or if he had any tobacco, he always begged me for something. I forgot whether he kept the pound I gave him back or not. I think he did. At any rate, I left there and then. It was my first job in New Zealand. I was hanging about in Ongarong and Waipa for 2 or 3 months, absolutely fed up. There was a bit of a pressure on at that time in 1906. Wool prices were low, sheep were low, everything was low. There was a bit of unemployment. I did work for 8 shillings a day, shovelling stones out of the creek for the roads and that sort of thing. Eventually I swallowed my pride and decided to go back teaching. I applied to the Education Board for a school, and in a very short time I was appointed as a teacher to Anaroa. Anaroa is just over the hills from Te Ari Hotel, that is. There is a road going over a very steep hill, and Anaroa was in there. Here was a patch of 600 acres of the most beautiful native bush you ever saw, and it was being cut down and milled to make butter boxes. A gang of about 30 men, I suppose, was employed on this job. The bush was nearly all kakata here and totara, down in the valley in direct line of sight with the bluff at Napier. At night time we could see the lights of Napier. Trees were being felled on a very steep slope. On the top of the hill was a winch with a steam engine which hauled up the logs out of the bush to the mill itself, which was situated on the flat at the crest of the hill. In fact, I've been to that place, it's still there. Bullocks are used to haul the logs to the tram line, which was 1 mile long and ran the whole length of the valley through the bush. Logs are put on a small wagon on the tram line and were then pulled up by the winds. The biggest totara tree that I've ever seen was in that particular bush. It was 9 foot through at sawing height. It was already down when I saw it, but it must have been a terrific job felling it. I don't know how many thousand feet of timber it cut. It was certainly a magnificent tree.
Where is Anaroa? Do you know?
Yes, I've been there. It's at just where he said it was. It's the back of from Te Ari.
Te Ari.
It's interesting because I have a friend that lives there on that farm where Dad worked, and he took me and showed me where the mill site was, and he's still there. This bush camp consisted of a cookhouse, single quarters and married quarters. There were also single men, of course, but about half were married and had families and needed school. Education Board supplied a teacher, that was myself, on the condition that the owner of the mill supplied the school building and a residence for the teacher. When I arrived, the school room was only half built, and my residence was a single man's worry with a wooden chimney lined with sheets of metal. A wooden frame bed with slats across and plenty of blankets, but no mattress. A wooden table and a chair. There were 24. I don't know exactly how many children at the school. I had them all, of course, from very junior, because the mothers liked to be rid of them almost as soon as they could walk, right up to standard 6. Some of the standard 4 and 5 were bigger and heavier than I was, which caused a bit of trouble time and again, as it would get a bit cheeky and it was hard to handle them. And I used to get in trouble with their parents because I would tune them up a bit occasionally. I was a school teacher there for 18 months, and though I was only getting 100 a year, less 10% because I was under 21. Fortunately, I would make a few bob after 3 o'clock by working on the sawmill for a couple of hours till 5 o'clock. I could never understand the regulation which prevented a teacher under 21 from getting full pay. At the mill, there was always some sort of job that needed doing, either in the yards or tailing out timber or something like that. This extra shilling an hour, the recognised wage then, was quite useful on top of my own salary. The time passed well, although I did get to know all the men on the mill. I didn't really make any friends, as we were really of a different class, something that has always annoyed me. Everyone called me Mr. Longley in New Zealand. They always have, and they still do. In England at school, you were just known by your surname, till your friends used your Christian name. In New Zealand, it's different. You insult a man by calling him by his surname. Unfortunately, I find Christian names hard to remember. And that is the end of that. Continuing on from being up at Akaroa, John was teaching at the Wimbledon School. The Wimbledon School was quite a small school, and it was there that he met my mother. If you can understand, back in those days, she would be probably 18. I would think she was 18 and 19 when she went to school for the first time. And she met the father there, and of course, what you're not meant to do, but they fell in love. And of course, my mother was the daughter of Thomas Charles Hales, and her mother was Amelia, and she was a daughter of the Lambert family, which first came in Prongau. My father, being fairly enterprising, and he liked the idea of going ahead and doing things, he had the opportunity of buying the Wimbledon store, which I think he probably talked his father-in-law into buying for my mother. My mother took over running the store during the day while my father was still teaching. At that stage, there was a coaching company that ran a coach from Herbertville to Dannevirke daily. My father, being mechanically minded, saw the opportunity of maybe making some more money, so he saved and bought a Minerva car, which was a big American open car, and he also bought a Cadillac as well. And he employed a driver who actually ended up working for my father for 45 years. That was successful. It was so successful that the wives liked the idea that when hubby went into Dannevirke to the sale and buy the stores, that he could come home and not get into trouble while he's in town. It was costing a fair bit of money in those days. On tyres was the biggest problem, because the tyres were not very well developed then, and the tyres on the big cars were fairly narrow and beaded edge tyres, and they just didn't like the wagon ruts, which of course dried out in the dry weather, and they slipped into that and tore the tyre. He was getting good money for that, so that business was running right. And then his father-in-law said to him, he said, look, I think at this stage you should be, there's a farm come up about 5 miles away from there, he says, I think we should buy that for you and get that going. They then bought the farm and they moved up there, and that was 1,000 acres. The father called it Tawadale because of all the tawa trees which were on it. It was in a big valley, and the tawa trees in there was Dale being English, so there came the name. They moved to a small lean-to place there. At that stage, I think they might have had about 4 children, I think. And then the Education Board got whiz of that he had all these other enterprises going. So they suggested maybe he should spend more time and not the teaching, which my dad thought may be a good idea. That's what happened. So the store was leased out, and it stayed leased out all the time I used to ride to school. I always used to stop there and get a penny's worth of licorice or something like that. And that got burnt down. My sister and her husband bought it off my mother, and they run the store for a few years. This was after the war, because my brother-in-law was a returned serviceman, so it was a start for them to get started. That's what happened there. Then they moved on, sold it, and unfortunately it was burnt down a few years later. So the store is no longer there. My father then built a big place at Tawadale, and I was born and raised there. I was the youngest of 6. And of course I went through the education and so forth in Whanganui because of the problem I had with pneumonia. I think I've already spoken about that. From there I got married, and then my mother and father, they moved over to the old vicarage at Prongau, which was quite interesting because being that he was involved with the vicarage, I suppose it's understandable he'd like to live in the old house again. But it was interesting at that stage because none of the other vicars, the modern vicars, wouldn't. It was too old and didn't want to live in it. My mum and dad got there and renovated it. The church had 5 acres of land there, which he run his Romney stud on.
Was this after you took the farm over?
Yeah, and that is where he ended his life, right there at the vicarage.
That's an amazing story, you know. The Lamberts and the Longleys certainly have some history between England and here. Well, now, after you took the farm over, what was the farm like? Was it fully developed?
Yeah, well, if you're going to understand from when my father took it over, was all scrub. He employed a Negro. They called him Big Jim. He was about 6 foot six, and my father had a heck of a job keeping slasher handles up to him. Oh, he was huge, yes. And he just happy just have a little tent and camp oven, which I've actually got, where yes. He used to cook his meals on. And I remember as a child going there, and I was real scared of this big, dark man, you know. He worked there for years, and then my father bought one of the first Fords and tractors to come into Hawke's Bay. The local farmers joked about it and said that, you know, slung off and said, oh, you know, some sort of farmer is going to fill all the gullies up with kerosene tins. Because, of course, the early one run on, you started on petrol.
That's
run
right, on kerosene. Yes.
And then the war came, and then, of course, all the men went to war, and sure. Of course, it was pretty terrible, like I remember it. Pretty bad in that area because we're only old people about trying to run yes. their farm. So Tarmadale had slipped back at that stage, and my dad was on his own and trying to do his best, but it had deteriorated. So when I took it over, it was in its second stage of being renovated. Yes.
Well, just coming back to the old Fordson tractor that your father had, that would have been on steel wheels, and it would have had one of those steel seats like they used to have on hay rakes to sit on,
yeah.
And it would have shook hell out of you and cooked you, yeah. The heat that used to come from those motors.
Yeah, the exhaust run under that's the back right. of them.
So what did he do with the tractor on the farm? Did they plough with it?
He had a plough, had a single furrow plough. I think it ploughed an 18-inch furrow. It was either an 18 or a 24, and I can't remember. And it was big enough to get enough weight of earth to hold the manuka back, keep it down to rot down. But he had a number of Fordson tractors until I remember he bought one from the Ford Motor Company in Waipuk, and they delivered it, or had it delivered, and dropped it off on the loading bank, and eventually sent Dad a bill for it. So he wrote back, said he wasn't paying for it, until they came and started it. I said, why? He said, well, it's still sitting where you dropped it off. We can't start it. So they sent experts out and everything, and after days and days, no one could start it. They had to take it back. And it was the one I remember that had big spikes on the wheels. Yes. They didn't change it much. It was from there that Dad had heard about these, being on the Waipuk Council. They'd bought themselves a Caterpillar tractor with a blade on it, and my dad thought that's what you'd need on the farm. So we bought the Caterpillar. The first one was a 22, it's a petrol run one.
They were great little tractors, though.
Oh, I didn't like it. You sat down too low on it, and you bounced about. It was pretty hard riding. We followed with the D2, and that was much better. But when I took the farm over, the D2 was still there, and I did not like the starting procedures of it whatsoever. You go and decide you're going to have an early start on the morning, and I couldn't get the starting
motor going.
There'd be probably more swear words made over those starting motors than any dog, I'm sure.
So when you changed, did you have Alice's after that?
Yes, that's when I bought the HD5 from Cable Price, the other importers.
You had to do some more scrub.
I bought an adjoining Maori block. I think I might have told you it was acquired, and that was in scrub, so that was where a lot of the clearance work was done. When I said that Dad passed away at the old vicarage at Bromley Hour, he had some unusual gifts that he never spoke about nowhere, and I was one of probably only two or three in the family that knew. And he said to my mother, he said, I'd like to get the family together. And she said, what for? Oh, he says, I think it's time. She said, oh, okay. When do you want them here by? Oh, he says, probably about Wednesday. So the family arrived, didn't know anyone, thought it was a family meeting or something. He knew I knew things, all right? He knew I was on that other side of thinking. I was when he said to my mother, he says, tell them to come in at 2 o'clock. They're all out having lunch, you know. Well, I went in and I went round one side of the bed and I knew what was going to happen. Mother took his hand on the other side and right back on 2 o'clock. That was it.
How would he have known that? That's incredible, isn't it? That really makes your mind work.
Oh, no. This is the sort of person he was. That's why people are amazed and how they're respecting that, because he just knew things, you know.
You were talking about that painting of the Archbishop of
yep.
Canterbury, and you made a comment that your family member that did that was able to do anything. Now, who was that family member? Was that your grandfather?
Yes, my grandfather.
And your father, right. The same.
Yeah.
Are you a painter?
No.
But you had other talents, yeah. That's fascinating, isn't it? People have said that they had a premonition of when they were... They actually did something similar, but not quite as calling the family together and saying, well, 2 o'clock's the time. Yeah. Well, I think that probably pretty well covers everything that we need.
For here, for yes. The father, I think so.
Yes. So, thank you, Ian.